I encourage you to open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 14. The Old Testament is going to be our focus this morning. 1 Samuel chapter 14. You know, if you want to go to battle with somebody else, one of the most important things that you have to do is count up how many guys you have on your side in your army compared to how many are on the other side in the other army, because you got to figure out if you are strong enough to beat that other person, that other force that's against you. And you know, that's something that Jesus himself talked about in the Gospels. When he's discussing counting the cost of becoming Jesus' disciple and whether or not you are strong enough to do it, he says in Luke 14:31, "What king going out to encounter another king in war will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000. So in terms of military strategy, I mean, we all understand, even if you're like me and you've never fired a gun, you've never faced a battle, you've never been in a war kind of situation, it's just basic common sense that you've got to count. You've got to carefully number your men and see if you can beat the opposite side or not. But the beautiful thing about the spiritual war that we're all fighting in is that numbers don't matter. Amen. Because we have God. Because God, our King, when He fights a battle, there is no amount of numbers that can stand against Him. And so if we fight on His side, no matter what our numbers are, we are guaranteed victory. We will win because we fight on His side. And so what I want to talk to you about this morning from 1 Samuel 14, when we look at something that Jonathan, King Saul's son, did in a story that I think sometimes goes overlooked, we're going to think about and be reminded of the fact that God can use a very small number of people to accomplish His work. And so read this with me, beginning in verse 1, if you would please. We're going to read it and then talk about what's going on in the text and then think about how this relates to us. Verse 1 of 1 Samuel 14. "One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side.' But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron, and the people who were with him were about 600 men, including Ahijah the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sina. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south side in front of Geba. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few.' And his armor bearer said to him, 'Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, heart and soul.' Then Jonathan said, 'Behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them. And if they say to us, "Wait until we come to you," then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, "Come up to us," then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand, and this shall be the sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us, and we will show you a thing." And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed them after him. And at that first strike, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length in an acre of land. And there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. And the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Count and see who has gone from us." And when they had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Now while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into battle. And behold, every Philistine sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. Now the Hebrews, who had been with the Philistines before that time, and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven. That's not the end of this whole narrative, but that's what we're going to focus on today, verses 1 through 23. So look with me at this remarkable story and what goes on in this text. I want you to notice, as we start looking at the first couple of verses a little bit more in depth, that what you have going on is a bunch of people kind of sitting on their hands. You have Saul, and you have about 600 guys, and you've got the Philistines, and you've got their army kind of camped over here on the opposite side, separated by crags, separated by some physical space. But everybody's just kind of waiting around, seeing what the other person is going to do. There's not much activity going on. Nobody's really active, including the king. Saul isn't doing anything. He's sitting in a pomegranate cave, eating pomegranates, I assume. I don't know exactly what he was doing, but he's not doing much. That's the point here. And so Jonathan... And by the way, I need to mention this too. Coming into chapter 14, things are not good for Saul. Because in chapter 13, God has just told him, "Your kingdom's not going to last. In fact, I'm going to take it away from you, and I'm going to give it to somebody else who's better than you are. Somebody who I trust to have the kingdom, not somebody that the people picked." And because he offered a sacrifice when he shouldn't have, he was fighting the Philistines, or he was going to, and the people were dispersing from him, and so he didn't wait for Samuel like he was supposed to, and sinned greatly against the Lord, and so God has already told him, "I'm yanking the kingdom away from you." That's the context coming in here. And so, but notice what his son does. Jonathan, very, very good man. He looks around at what's going on. He looks at the fact that his father's not doing anything. And he looks at the fact that you got all these Philistines over here just sitting right there. You know, the enemies of God, these uncircumcised guys. And so he just decides he's going to leave. He's going to go attack them himself with his armor bearer. And did you notice in the text that the Bible makes a big deal about the fact that nobody knew he was going? You know, verse 1 says he didn't tell his dad what he was doing. And I don't know if that was because he was worried that his dad would say, no, absolutely not. You're not going to go fight the Philistines. Or if he just wanted to make sure that his dad wouldn't worry about him. I don't know exactly what was going on there. But he didn't tell his dad. And verse 3 tells us he didn't tell anybody else in the army. You know, he's not tooting his horn on the way out saying, hey guys, you know, you're all sitting around twiddling your thumbs, but I'm going to go out there with my one guy here, and we're going to start swinging our swords at these Philistines. He's very hush-hush about this and just quietly exits and starts climbing up these rocky crags to the Philistine camp. And the amazing thing is, this just blows my mind, because in terms of military strategy, this is a really, really stupid idea for the crown prince of Israel, who is heir to the throne of his father, to just go up there by himself, practically. We've got one guy with him, and just start attacking this whole garrison of soldiers with this whole army behind the garrison. But God tremendously blesses this attack. And notice how the text says when they get up to the Philistines, they're not exactly sure what's going to happen. You know, they're having this conversation with each other, and Jonathan is saying, hey, okay, here's this plan. We're going to go up there, and if they say this, we'll attack. If they say this, we won't attack. But it may be, he says that, it may be that the Lord is going to use us and work some great things through us, but they don't know in verse 6 what's going to happen, but he is positive, because he says this, that the Lord does not depend on numbers to fight his battles. Because he says there in that verse, in verse 6, the Lord can save by many or by few. And that is such a contrast to Saul's attitude. Go back to chapter 13 and look at verse 11. When you look at chapter 13, verse 11, what did Saul say to Samuel when Samuel said, what are you doing? How could you offer a sacrifice when you were supposed to wait for me to do this? Remember, Saul said, I was counting up people. I was counting heads, and I could see that they're all scattering from me. I'm worried about numbers, and that's why I did this. Chapter 13, verse 15, what does he do? Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. And that's now what we get in chapter 14, verse 2. The people who are with him are about 600 guys. He's so concerned with how many guys, how many men do I have? And what's the first thing that happens after he sees the Philistines are all in disarray and there's confusion and he doesn't know what's going on in the camp? What's the first thing he does? He says, okay, count the people. Count the people. We got to see who's missing here. And that's the first time he figures out, oh, my son's gone with his armor bearer. And okay, well, in that case, then we'll go attack. But you notice how fixated he is on how many people he has. But look what the Lord does with Jonathan, because Jonathan doesn't care a whit about numbers. Look at, in the verses that we just read, verse 14, the first strike kills about 20 men, and we're told that the size of the land on which this happens, we're told that it was about half a furrow's length in an acre. That is a small enough field that basically a team of oxen can plow that in about half a day. So it's not a huge area of land here where this garrison is. But look at else how God blesses this. So they start winning this little micro battle that they've got going on. But you notice in verse 15, it says that there was an earthquake in this place where they were fighting the Philistines. And there's this great confusion. Everybody is being thrown up in an uproar, and that is all evidence of the hand of God. That's not Jonathan. Jonathan is the one with the sword, swinging it, attacking these people. But God is the one who is behind all of this and making this thing succeed, despite the fact that this is just two guys who are doing this amazing thing. And then when you look at the last part of what we read, you see the rest of the Israelites kind of looking over what's happening, and they all start to get on board, including King Saul, even though he acts in a really kind of confused way as he first sees what's going on. At first they don't know what is happening, but he counts the men, and then he orders the priest to bring up the Ark of the Covenant, and the implication is that he wants the priest to inquire of God and get some sort of answer from God about what's going on, what they should do. But you notice how he tells the priest as he's talking, you know, he can see what's going on. It's getting more worked up. And so he tells the priest, actually, I changed my mind. Withdraw your hand. Don't ask God what to do. We're just going to get our armor and our weapons, and we're just going to go for it. And so he gathers the people, and they start to attack. But you notice in 21 and 22, there's this beautiful chain reaction that happens. Because in 21, did you notice in the text it said that there were Israelites who were inside of the camp of the Philistines? And I'm assuming that they were helping the Philistines, that they're there supporting them, doing things for them. I don't know exactly what that means, but they're there in the camp with the Philistines, with the enemy, and they start turning against the Philistines. And then you've got, in verse 22, you've got some Hebrews who are hiding out in the hills, and they come out of the hills and start fighting. And this all started because one man decided to start attacking. And look at verse 23. So the Lord saved Israel that day. Not Jonathan, but the Lord. And actually, did you know that that phrase, the Lord saved Israel that day, that's a direct quote from Exodus 14. Remember, right after the Israelites are saved from the Egyptians, they're coming out in the Exodus, and the Lord has opened up the Red Sea, and He's brought them across dry land, and He's closed it up on the Egyptian soldiers who are fanatically running after them, trying to grab them and take them back to slavery. It says in Exodus 14, verse 30, this very phrase, the Lord had saved Israel that day. The real hero of the Exodus was not Moses, even though he held up his hands with his staff and did some things. The real hero of that was God. The real hero of 1 Samuel 14 is not Jonathan or his armor bearer, but is God, who used them to accomplish His will. Now, there are some tremendous lessons from this spectacular I just love Jonathan, I love this text, and I'm excited to share some of these things with you today as we think about what this means for us. And the first thing that I think we can see is that taking action and doing things for the Lord does not depend on receiving these public orders, these public directions on what to do. You know, you think about how Jonathan could have and maybe said some things to himself and created some justifications in his own mind for just sitting there and doing nothing. He could have said, well, I'm not the king. My father's the king, and it's his job to go out there and fight our battles and to lead us, and he's not doing anything. He's just sitting around in his pomegranate cave, and so I can't do anything. I mean, I'm the crown prince, but I don't have any control over the situation. And since everybody else just wants to sit around, there's not much that I can do personally. That was not his attitude. He just had the mindset of, I'm going to do what I can do, what is within my control to accomplish God's will, despite what everybody else is doing. Think about how this hits you and I individually. When you look around at this congregation, because no congregation of God's people is perfect, none of us individually are perfect. And I know personally, if you look at my life and what I do on a daily basis, you're going to see plenty of things that are not how they should be. No group of God's people is exactly doing what they're supposed to do. When you look around at this group, you're going to see holes. You're going to see things that are not as they should be. But you and I have a choice about what our reaction is going to be when we look around and we see those holes. Are we going to sit on our hands and criticize the other Christians around us? Because I'm looking around and this person's not doing their job, and this person is not as active as they should be, and this is a problem, and that's a problem, and this is an issue. Maybe we've got a point. Maybe there are issues that we genuinely see, but are we just going to sit around and criticize, or are we actually going to have a Jonathan-like attitude about this and decide that I'm going to do everything that I possibly can do personally to plug that hole that I see over here, instead of just pointing at it and saying, there's a hole? That wasn't Jonathan's attitude. We've got to be careful that we take his mindset and we put it into our own minds. And just to give a concrete example of what we're talking about here, I appreciate the public way that the elders have recently just said, you know, we're concerned about Sunday afternoon hospitality. And that in the way that we have restructured our Sunday services, that in the elders' minds, that was something that they were hoping would take place. And so Steve got up and he just publicly said in front of all of us, you know, we're putting our heads together with the deacons and we're going to try to figure this out. And I so appreciate the work that they are investing in trying to help us figure out how to get together on a more regular basis and become more one as a congregation. They're doing good work in that. But are we just sitting around waiting for public orders to come down to us? Or are we actually just going to start having people over in our homes? Or regardless of what happens in a public kind of way, I just want to use the analogy of a shepherd and his sheep for just a second, because the Bible often talks in terms of that. You know, do the sheep come up to the shepherd every day and say, okay, what are we going to do today? Does the shepherd have to give all the sheep a talk and say, okay, sheep, you got to eat lots of grass today. You got to drink lots of water, because that's how you get plump and healthy, and that's how you, you know, stay how you're supposed to grow in and all that. No, the shepherd doesn't have to do that, because the sheep just naturally do what sheep do. They eat the grass. They drink the water. Now, the shepherd is supposed to lead the sheep to good pastures and create an environment for good, healthy sheep eating and sheep drinking, and to make sure that wolves are not attacking the sheep, to make sure the sheep are protected and safe. That is the shepherd's job. But the sheep don't have to eat a clump of grass and then look at the shepherd and say, okay, now what? Well, go eat that clump of grass. Okay. Okay, now what do I do? Sheep do what sheep do. And that's what we're supposed to be like within a congregation of God's people. We're supposed to look at what our chief shepherd has said for us to do and to do it with zeal, looking to what we know is right. And so what sort of sheep are you and I in this flock of God's people? And that's something for us to think about. Are we active? Are we doing the work of the Lord zealously with initiative? Or are we just sitting on our hands, well, I'm waiting for the elders to hand down an edict? I mean, that's not what we're supposed to be having in our minds. And something else that is so crucial to understand, I think, about this chapter is that enthusiastic partners are so crucial and so important when we want to take initiative and do God's work. You know, this chapter could have gone so very differently than it did. Jonathan could have left the camp without consulting anybody at all, but he didn't. He didn't talk to most people, but he did talk to one guy. And you know, the armor bearer could have said a lot of different things than he did. You know, the armor bearer said, yes, that's great. I'm going to go with you. I'm there heart and soul. I mean, he said in just the strongest possible terms that I'm going to do this enthusiastically with you. But you know what he could have said? He could have been resistant. He could have said, that is an idiotic idea, and there is no way I'm going to let the crown prince of Israel go up there and fight this battle, just the two of us, or just you. Or he could have been passive. He could have said, well, Jonathan, you can do what you want to do. You can go up there by yourself. I'm going to stay here and snooze in the camp some more. But instead, he was zealous, and he was supportive, and he was excited, and he said, let's do it. And true to his word, he climbed up there up the crag, and he started attacking full force. He didn't kind of hang back and say, okay, Jonathan, I'll be with you in a minute. But he's right there swinging the sword with him. Do you remember what Jesus did when he sent out the 72 disciples in the Gospels? Especially in Luke chapter 10 and verse 1. Do you remember that he sent them out in pairs? Two by two. Why did he do that? Why didn't he just scatter them all individually out there to start casting out demons and preaching and doing the miracle work that they're supposed to do? Because he understood, in the way that he's created us, in the way that he has set things up, that we are more effective in God's work when we have armor bearers with us. And isn't that what Ecclesiastes says in chapter 4? Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his brother, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. God has designed us to unify ourselves around him, and so he's created us to need human companionship. Not just so that we can feel good during the day, but so that we can have somebody to work there alongside of us to help us do what God wants us to do. And so we need somebody with us who's going to say, yes, I see the value in that work, and I'm going to be right there beside you doing it. We need people around us who are not just going to say, I think that's great, you go do that, more power to you, but somebody who's actually going to put a practice behind the good words that they're speaking to us and actually be there for us in that work. Because that's what Jonathan had, and I'm not sure what this text would look like if he didn't have that guy standing beside him doing this work. And one last point about what we can learn from this text, and this is just so neat to me, is that our excitement for God's work can create this massive chain reaction of workers who see what is going on and want to participate with us in the work. You notice that our text starts with one guy having an idea in his mind and a plan, and the text ends in verse 23 with this entire army from all these different places who are attacking the Philistines with Jonathan, but it all started with him. Verse 21. People are on the other side of the enemy. They come over. Verse 22, people are scared to death. They're hiding in the hills, but they come out of their holes and start fighting. This is so neat that when we decide individually we're going to do the work of the Lord, that sometimes people who we least expect are going to help come out of the woodwork and perform the work of the Lord in the same kind of way that we're trying to do. I've seen it happen many times. I've seen it happen here. And it's so encouraging to watch that take place. We've got to have this mindset that just one person can change the culture of a family, can change the culture of a congregation, can change the culture of a group of people who see this one person doing what is right. I use the word can for a reason, because again, verse 6, Jonathan didn't know, going into all this, what was going to happen. And we may not see with our own eyes the effects and the results of our work as we become like Jonathan's, but we do know from this text that God uses zealous people. He can use zealous individuals to accomplish his work. And I want to go back to the idea in Philippians 1 that Herbie read for us before I got up here. Did you catch what Paul said in Philippians 1:14, where he's talking about how he is stuck in a prison in Rome, is where we think that he wrote that letter. And you remember what he said about the other Christians in Rome and the effect of his imprisonment that it had on them? I'm just going to read you again from verse 14 of Philippians 1, where he says, "And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear." Evidently, in Rome, there was not a whole lot of speaking out about Jesus, a whole lot of evangelism going on in amongst the Christians there. But then Paul got put in prison and everything changed. And they looked at Paul, this one guy, they looked at how he was using his imprisonment, and they all looked at him, and he says, most of the brothers had this huge surge of faith, and they become evangelistic. And that is proof of this point. This is not just an obscure Old Testament text that has no relevance for us as Christians. In Philippians 1, here's a Christian who's doing this. And it's creating this massive chain reaction, and everybody is built up by what Paul is doing. That's our encouragement from this text. And so what I want to leave you with is verse 6, which I believe is the main point of everything that happens in 1 Samuel 14, 1-23, that nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many. Could use many, but he can also use few. As in two. As in one. Anybody who wants to put their hand to the plow can be used. Did you know, three chapters later, from 1 Samuel 14, there's another story that is very much like this. You remember what happens? Just three chapters later, another young Israelite man comes to the camp of the Israelites and sees that they're really twiddling their thumbs and they're not doing much, and you got the Philistines over here, and you got this big giant who comes out every day and says, "Give me a man to fight," and nobody fights him. And this young Israelite man, who's very, very much like Jonathan, runs out to him and throws a stone at his head, and then cuts it off. And then it starts this massive chain reaction, and the Philistines are defeated again. Jonathan looked at that young man and said, "I got to get close to that guy. And I'm going to give him my weapons, and I'm going to knit my soul to his soul, because he gets it in a way that these other people don't." Do we get it? Do we understand the power that our God can wield through just one of us? You may not feel like you matter a whole lot in your life. And you may look at the things that you have tried to do for the Lord's cause, and you may look at how on a physical level it looks like failure. And it looks like you don't affect the course of the world or the course of your family or the course of this congregation. But I just want to put this before your mind again, that you matter tremendously. The Lord can do things through your life that you can't even imagine. Please believe in the power of this message. And if you are not part of the Lord's army this morning, if you don't have this goal that the Lord can do things through you and fight battles through you that you cannot have anticipated, if you understand who the Lord and Savior is and you want to join His cause and you want to make that known to us so that we can baptize you in His name, or you want to come back and rejoin His army, let us help you out. I don't know how much more time you have, or I have, or any of us have in this spiritual fight before the Lord comes back and closes everything up and is victorious. But let's use today. Let's use what we've got to affect the lives around us for the King. come forward if you need to this morning as we stand up and sing the invitation song.